You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Kohl's has avoided another takeover attempt from activist investors on Wall Street. A Wisconsin business writer tells us what happened and why she thinks the takeover plan would have been bad for the store and maybe employees and customers, too. Now, recent declines in the stock market are being led, in some cases, by technology companies. Even some big names like Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google have dropped significantly since the start of the year. A lot of those companies continued to thrive through the pandemic as the rest of the economy struggled. That seems to be coming to an end. The drop-off has been compared to the dot-com bubble that burst in the early 2000s. It's a different financial world now. Aaron Griffith is a reporter for the New York Times who covers technology startups and venture capital. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, between the time we called you to come on and now, today happened a big drop in the stock market overall. Like what, I assume the technology stocks are part of this?
Yeah, I mean, they have sort of been on the bleeding edge of this sell-off, you know, as investors rotate out of high growth and high risk stocks into, you know, sort of more reliable stocks that maybe are, you know, kind of blue chip that have paid dividends and that have sort of slow and steady growth, because I think they're sort of realizing that the crazy growth that a lot of tech companies saw in the pandemic is certainly slowing way down. And they're also seeing that there's a lot of uncertainty out there between all of the macro factors that I'm sure we'll get into.
You wrote a piece recently looking at years of people saying, yeah, we're in a technology stock bubble and it's going to burst any day now. And it doesn't burst. It keeps going on and on. Is it finally happening?
You know, it's been about like 12 to 15 years of just a bull market, you know, and everyone has these scars from the dot-com bubble in 2000 when that burst, and is kind of just anticipating and looking for signs of that happening again. And so every time things got a little bit overheated over the last decade, you know, everyone is very quick to say, oh no, it's the bubble again. Everyone get ready. This is the big one, because they have those memories of how painful that was when the bubble burst in 2000. And it just hasn't happened. You know, we've had low interest rates for over a decade now, basically since the financial crisis of 2008. And that has pushed investors to continue to take more and more risks. And so that brings them, you know, into the high growth and high risk tech startup category. And they've been, you know, fueling huge growth in that category for a long time. And investors have reaped the profits of that. I mean, you know, Facebook becoming a $1 trillion company that, like, you know, was just a startup over a decade ago. And so you've seen that huge value can be created out of these companies, but there is that risk. And so a lot of people are, you know, eager and very willing to raise the flags, even though it just seemed to keep going up over and over and over. This time could be different. And that's what everyone's kind of looking and waiting to see. There's just a lot of macro factors, inflation, the interest rates going up for the first time in a very long time, the war in Russia and in the Ukraine, and the uncertainty that has created, the continued supply chain disruptions. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. And so investors are starting to kind of pull back the risk that they've been taking for such a long time.
I think there's a perception for like Silicon Valley type startups that I could come up with, you know, I've invented this web-enabled toothpaste, and there's going to be a venture capitalist who'll just shower money at me, even if it's a stupid idea and I won't make any money doing it ever. I mean, how close to reality is that perception?
I mean, I would say for the last 2 years, it's been a lot closer than ever before. I mean, the pandemic really showed investors that there's huge opportunities. It's speeding up, accelerating the adoption of new technology. A lot of people talked about how, you know, it was 5 years of tech adoption that was crammed into 6 months when we all went into lockdown in early 2020. And that was this huge opportunity. And so, you know, people were just showering money on startups, some of them very, you know, sort of half-baked. And so I did feel like a kind of out-of-control frenzy for a little while there. And I think now we're seeing that come back down to earth, and it's going to be painful for some startups. And, you know, others will figure out how to cut costs and, you know, maybe slow their hiring and return to a sort of a more reasonable growth. And they'll weather this and be stronger on the other side. But, yeah, it did really feel like things got kind of frenzied and out of control for the last at least year and a half.
Let's look at something like Amazon, where it was already big and huge. And then with the pandemic, all these people were learning, even if they hadn't ordered online before, learning to become Amazon mm-hmm. customers. Are people just going back to stores now? Or are we just kind of going back to earth in that way?
It's true. I mean, I guess part of it is like the gains have been locked in to some extent for some of these companies because behaviors have changed. But at the same time, I think a lot of people dumped money into tech thinking this is the new reality. This is the future. We're going to be on Zoom forever. And, you know, after a little while, everyone kind of realized, oh, I'm tired of that. I want to go back to in-person stuff. Or maybe I like picking out my own groceries and I'll order online occasionally. Or I don't want to pay these high fees to order takeout all the time. I'm just going to go to the restaurant now that it's open again. So I think, you know, investors maybe got a little ahead of themselves in baking in future growth for some of these new behaviors that we adopted during the pandemic. And at the same time, I mean, the companies are still growing and behaviors had changed, but maybe just not to the extent that the stock prices reflected.
Is the culture changing now? If I show up with my pitch for my e-toothpaste, am I getting more doors slammed in my face today than I would have a year ago?
You know, venture capitalists are sounding the alarm on Twitter. I mean, every day there's news of another startup that's doing layoffs or that's struggling to raise funding. And the VCs are out there saying, oh no, the sky is falling. And it's kind of funny because they were also the same ones that were kind of pumping up the hype machine and the investment frenzy that we saw over the last couple of years. But that has changed faster than I've probably ever seen it in the last decade. You know, the investors have become very, very cautious, and it's become pretty hard for founders to raise money if they don't have something to show for it, or they can't show, you know, a path to actually turning a profit. And certainly the valuations that had gotten really, really frothy and, you know, away from the fundamentals of what the business can actually deliver have come down to earth. And so a lot of companies are facing a reality check on that front too.
How connected is what's going on with cryptocurrencies right now? There's a lot of talk, a lot of hype about them being great vehicles during an uncertain economy, during times of high inflation. Here we are. They've done poorly lately, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, that's been an interesting thing because that has been the selling point. Like, buying Bitcoin is a hedge against inflation, but in fact, in an inflationary time, Bitcoin's going down now. So yeah, it is kind of a little bit of a head scratcher on that message. And I think part of that is that, you know, it is a risky investment. And like I said, people are cycling out of risk and they see their money falling in Bitcoin and they're like, crap, I don't want to lose anymore. And so the fear kind of creates more fear. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that sort of plays out. And I would say more broadly in the crypto world, I mean, a lot of these projects were very fly by night. And we saw a massive collapse last week with one of them called Luna that was supposed to be tied to a stable coin. And so I think people are starting to sort of question, you know, okay, how exposed do I want to be to this if some of these projects go all the way to zero? And you know, the crypto industry, unlike the tech industry, is still relatively young. And so there's a lot of noise in there. And, you know, it's going to be really rocky, I think, in that category.
Apart from sorting through what happened today on the stock market, Aaron, what are you watching for next with technology stocks?
You know, the IPO market is pretty much closed right now. And we did see one of the biggest, most valuable startups, announced in maybe last week that it was planning to try to go public. And so I'll be really curious to see if tech startups start trying to test the market. And if a company is able to go public in this market, that means that investors might be willing to try, you know, testing out, taking on a little risk, backing a high growth company again. Right now, the market's pretty much closed. So that's what I'll be looking for to see, you know, if suddenly the investors start getting greedy again, because, you know, like Warren Buffett and many investors say, you know, the time to buy is when everyone's being fearful. And so if that changes quickly, then, you know, that could mean that this downturn that we're seeing right now won't last that long. And it'll be just like the ones that we've seen, the little mini blips that we've seen over the last decade, where it's a moment or a few months of fear and then things just come zooming right back. Right now, the mood is quite grim out there, and it seems like people are really settling in for a longer downturn. But if companies start going public again and there's a new demand for risk, then, you know, that could change.
Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Aaron Griffith with the New York Times with us today to look at why tech company stocks are falling and how the industry is responding. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about foraging for a Wisconsin delicacy.
Morel mushrooms are a coveted treat in Wisconsin every spring, but the right conditions for finding them can be as finicky and moody as the state's springtime weather. yet the result is well worth the effort. Writer Mark Griffin takes you on a journey to find that elusive morel mushroom.
Welcome to Wisconsin's premier morel hunting expedition. Is this your first time hunting with us? Wonderful. You're sure to find success, just like I have, exactly twice since 2010. That's when I began hunting these very woods myself. Yep, exactly twice. And no, I have not had any training whatsoever, but that's what the internet is for, right? There's a massive tract of wilderness in front of us, hundreds of acres of trees, grasses, prairie, swamps, and streams. Somewhere over this box of green lie our golden treasures, the morel mushrooms, poking their obscene little noggins out from under the underbrush. And if we search long enough for them, we'll find those elusive fleshy brains. But neither of us have all day, so out of this necessity, we'll refine our search. Under a log, next to a fallen oak tree, a shady spot on a steeper grade where, a few years ago, I had some luck myself. Pinpointing the few choicest spots is what you're paying me good money for. And yet, you will note in the contract you sign that my flagrantly minimal morel hunting expertise does not guarantee success. But what if we discover nothing? Then we have failed, and me spectacularly so as your guide and leader. Yet in that process, we will have achieved something else. We will become accustomed to zooming in on the landscapes in front of us, combing the painted underbrush and thorny thickets for those elusive spongy fungi. We may find the perfect fallen ash to rest. Slowly, everything begins to shrink. The tiny becomes large. The large fuzzes out of focus. That buckthorn, unavoided, scrapes your shin, but refrains its sting. The fly landing on your hat is left unswatted to catch a warm break. In the light breeze, the leaves on the farthest branch of that aspen perform the dance they were meant to do on this earth, the shiver and quake. We start to notice something different in the afternoon light as well. Then we begin to empathize with the still undiscovered morel mushrooms of the day. They're enjoying a cloak of invisibility just over that hill, I'm sure, beyond the map, just out of reach. Let them go from our expectations. Let go of the need to do and finish and accomplish this morel hunting task that, let's be clear, could absolutely be completed with the right expertise and luck, neither of which you enjoy today. Do we have any other choice? An oak savanna, long and familiar, breathes a simple sigh. Now's the time in our adventure where I cut you loose for a few minutes to search on your own and... Oh, what's that? You found some? Already? Huh. Well, I guess we'll just call it beginner's luck, won't we? So you did find what you were looking for today, the elusive morel mushroom. Are you ready to go home now?
Writer Mark Griffin brought us that story about hunting for morel mushrooms. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a Wisconsin business writer joins the show to talk about the latest on Kohl's fight with some Wall Street investors. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Kohl's has been a target of some Wall Street investors who say the company isn't generating enough value for its shareholders. Last week, the Menominee Falls retailer avoided another takeover attempt. In a recent column from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, our guest says the Wall Street investors looking to shake up Kohl's are using an old, tired, and greedy strategy. Kathleen Gallagher is executive director of the Five Lakes Institute, which promotes innovation and entrepreneurship in the Great Lakes region. She won a Pulitzer Prize during her time as a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She writes a regular column there now. Kathleen, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Nice to be back.
Remind us what sparked this takeover attempt.
Well, you said it, greed. A New York firm that does this a lot. They love to go after retailers, because particularly retailers who have a lot of land, you know, stores that they own. They like to go after them, and one of the things they like to do, I don't want to get too complicated on you, but what they like to do is use the real estate that these retailers have to back their acquisition, you know, as collateral for loans they get to acquire the retailer. So it's like they're using the retailer's real estate to make the acquisition, if that makes sense.
Sure. And then is this a thing where, you know, maybe they make money in the short run, but it's not that healthy for the store in the long run? I remember reading something similar about, I think, Toys R Us.
Well, or Sears. You know, mm-hmm. Sears is the big example where, you know, this guy came in, started running Sears, and basically used all the real estate to borrow money. And it turned into not Sears anymore, right?
So what has the current leadership of Kohl's said about its long-term viability in a market that can be tough for big retail stores?
Well, they're really locked onto a new strategy. You know, they have this CEO, Michelle Gass, who's been there for a couple of years, and she's got a strategy that she keeps pushing. The big piece of the strategy right now that people have probably seen in the stores is this partnership with Sephora. And from what I can see in my Kohl's store, you know, they move the jewelry and put right front and center the cosmetics area run by, you know, that is a partnership with Sephora. And I think cosmetics probably have higher margins. So, you know, she's arguing that's the thing that's going to help Kohl's come out of this. There are other parts to it, like a focus on athletic wear, which is popular right now, that kind of stuff. So.
Now, Kohl's is a national chain, but of course, it's based in Wisconsin, big employer here in Wisconsin. So some people are listening and thinking, what does this mean for my job? What does fending off this takeover attempt mean for people who, you know, actually work for Kohl's?
Well, there are two kinds of jobs, right? There are the people who work at a Kohl's store, and, you know, that would depend on... Well, let me back up. There are, I assume, still five offers for Kohl's. I mean, what happened is these people went at Kohl's, this activist firm in New York, and everybody said, oh, let's get in on this. You know, we could make an offer. We can do something with it. So there are a bunch of offers for Kohl's. And so it would depend upon who bought them and, you know, whether they were viewing it as a real estate play or a retail, enhancing the retail brand, right? So for the people who work in the stores, a lot would depend on what kind of acquirer got hold of the company. If that happened, Kohl's seems to have fended it off. The real jobs that I think we're talking about are at the headquarters. You know, if someone bought Kohl's, it's pretty unlikely that all those headquarters jobs would stay in the Milwaukee area.
Yeah, there was this attempt. The current management fended it off. But as you say, there are other offers on the table. Are they going to just be here next week, next month, and so on as different groups try to make offers or do takeovers?
Well, the argument I'm making in this column is that because the economy is changing so fast, it's changing these types of offers. You know, for the last 20 years, with low interest rates and high real estate values, it's made sense to make these kind of offers because you can go after the real estate, you can finance it with low interest rates. I'm arguing, you know, interest rates are obviously going up. When interest rates go up, real estate values go down. I'm arguing this kind of offer isn't going to work anymore. So my argument is it won't work. There's an analyst at Morningstar, David Schwartz, who I talked to for this column, and he was just quoted the other day in a Journal Sentinel article about what's going to happen next. He thinks, you know, they're going to keep coming at Kohl's. Kohl's is going to have to fight it off. Kohl's should sell now. You know, he feels very differently than I do. I just think the economy is going to help Kohl's in the long run.
During especially the earliest days of the pandemic, stores weren't able to open. Even when they were, people might have been shy about going into them. That, as we were just hearing in our previous interview, helped Amazon for a while. Is there a sense, Kathleen, that, you know, things are back to normal-ish? People are happy to go back and shop in stores like Kohl's?
Well, certainly they have more traffic with the pandemic not being as severe. the argument I'm making in this column is that, you know, I think Amazon may have peaked. You know, when you think about it, Amazon depends on cheap credit, you know, cheap, low interest rates, cheap energy to move stuff around, and cheap labor, and all of those things are changing, you know. So that's going to change Amazon. Is it going to make sense to have the delivery person who doesn't want to work for the pay that they can get from Amazon delivering a product using gas to get it there? You know, I don't know. It's the pandemic plus this changing economic environment, I'm arguing.
Now, this fight isn't over. As you say, more offers still on the table. What are you watching for next in the story of Kohl's?
I mean, I'm kind of watching the economy, right? And one of the other points I made in the column is that, you know, these activist investors are saying, you know, they're so dumb. They're not doing anything with their real estate. They've got all these stores and, you know, they could be, it's called a sale leaseback. They could be selling the real estate and leasing the property to run their stores, which I think Kohl's argument is, well, if we do that, next time we hit a downturn, we have these big rent payments that we don't have now, and then we're in trouble, you know, which if you're worried about the short term, you don't care about. One of the arguments I'm making in the column is John Schlifsky, who's the CEO of Northwestern Mutual, is on Kohl's board. You know, this is a big insurance company that has, you know, a lot of money that it invests and understands real estate. I'm kind of guessing that he understands this. I just think going into what the new economic reality that we're headed for, that Kohl's has a real shot of surviving this. But like I said, this guy at Morningstar in Chicago, you know, he says there's going to be another proxy fight and they're going to have to sell.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Kathleen Gallagher, talking about her column in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the future of Kohl's. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to the author of a new book that argues our economic system needs to be reformed to be less reliant on the Federal Reserve and put more responsibility back on Congress. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we learn about the causes of the baby formula shortage and get advice from a pediatric nutritionist on what parents can do. First, the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates lately in an effort to combat inflation. But should the Federal Reserve have so much responsibility over our economic well-being? Our guest today argues that the U.S. relies too much on the central banking system, and he offers some solutions for a more stable way to manage the economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the Federal Reserve and the U.S. banking system? Do you support what the Fed has done lately to keep the economy afloat during the pandemic? Do you worry about mission creep since the Great Recession and the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Lev Menand is an associate professor of law at Columbia Law School. He's a former U.S. Treasury official. His new book is The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. Lev, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
You spent a whole chapter on this, Lev, but let's start with the basics in a nutshell. What is the Federal Reserve supposed to do? What is its main tool to do it?
Federal Reserve was founded in 1913 to perform a limited purpose, to administer a system of investor-owned chartered banks, banks like J.P. Morgan Chase that we know today, Bank of America, Citigroup, and to ensure that the banking system collectively makes enough money for everybody to use. And the money that banks make are called deposits. Banks issue deposits and they expand and contract their balance sheet. They issue more or fewer deposits by extending loans. And the Fed's job is to ensure that the amount of bank money, the amount of deposits in the economy is sufficient for the economy to operate at full potential. That means maximum employment, price stability, and moderate long-term interest rates in the long run.
We We talk sometimes about the Fed's job being to control inflation and to maximize employment and reduce unemployment. As you write it, and as you just said it, that's kind of like a secondary outcome. If they're doing that first thing right, making sure there's the right amount of money in the economy, those other things should, in theory, follow?
That's exactly right. And this is a common misconception throughout Washington, throughout policy debates. The Fed's mission is not employment directly. It's not price stability directly. It's not the Fed's job to ensure that inflation is always 2%. The Fed's job is monetary. It's to ensure that the amount of money in the economy is consistent with long-run stable prices, long-run full employment. And Congress thought when it created the Fed and when it gave the Fed that mission, which was in 1977, that there were a lot of other government agencies who would have to work on things like addressing supply shocks that might cause inflation to be high today or promoting full employment. The Fed's job was monetary. It was a piece of the puzzle, not designed to be the sole macroeconomic agency of the federal government.
Still a pretty big job. But then along comes the financial institutions collapsing that caused the Great Recession. And as you write it and as you chart it, the Fed's job got way, way bigger. What happened?
Yeah. So what happened is over about a 40 to 50 year period, accelerating in the 80s and 90s, the banking system really deteriorated. So the Fed was constructed to manage a system where banks are producing most of the money. Bank deposits are the main monetary instrument. And what you have is the emergence of a shadow banking system, an unregulated set of financial companies that wants to copy the bank business model but not play by the rules. Not follow bank regulation. And they emerge and they get quite large. And some of them, listeners will be familiar with, like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, ran into a lot of trouble in 2008. And Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. And these shadow banks by 2008 were playing a major role in the monetary system. But the Fed wasn't designed to administer them, control them, oversee them in the way that it was designed to administer the banking system. And this has just created a world of pain, both for the Fed and for the American people since 2008. And unfortunately, in 2022, we still live in an economy where shadow banks play a major role and the Fed is trying to stabilize them without the right set of tools to do so.
Yeah, and they were kind of improvising tools, you write, back in 2008. What kind of things did the Fed do to extend its toolkit awkwardly to deal with the collapse of some of these shadow banks?
So the Fed aggressively interpreted its legal authorities and set up a variety of ad hoc lending facilities to try to provide the same sort of backstopping that is sort of coded in the law to provide for the banking system, to provide that for the shadow banking system, to ensure that the money, basically, the cash substitutes that the shadow banking system was creating, that those would be exchangeable for cash. So if you think about it, the reason you're willing to hold a deposit instead of government-issued cash is because if you go to your bank, you can get cash for it. There's that that convertibility. And that convertibility, banks are only able to do that because of a whole system the government has set up and the Fed standing behind it, making cash available to banks if they need it. That system doesn't exist for shadow banks. And so the Fed sort of, they jury-rigged a system like that in 2008 so that all of the shadow banks that were issuing their own sort of cash substitutes, there was runs on all of those institutions and they didn't have the cash. And so the Fed tried to make the cash available to them to stop the runs and prevent the entire financial system from basically freezing up.
Talking to Lev Menand about his new book called The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in with your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234 about the role of the Federal Reserve. And do you think Congress should be more at the center of managing economic problems like, say, inflation? Call 800-642-1234. Okay, Lev, the goal here of these improvised tools from the Fed to prevent a full collapse of the financial system, it worked, right? We had a great recession. We didn't have a great depression. So what's wrong with what the Fed did?
So two things. One is there's a qualification on it worked. The Great Recession was great because it didn't actually work that well. We had a much sharper downturn. We had what might be called a hard landing because of the financial system's malfunctions in the fall of 2008. So it took the Fed a while to get the situation under control. The failure of Lehman Brothers and panic in various parts of the financial market meant that credit provisioning froze up, and that meant that hundreds of thousands of people lost their job and ultimately millions lost their homes, a circumstance that was preventable in the sense that this was a product of dysfunction in the monetary and financial system. It wasn't because of a natural disaster like a flood or a pandemic. It was because the system didn't work properly. And that is a catastrophe. And it's an own goal for the U.S. economy. And so the first caveat is it only worked. It worked, but not as well as it should have. The other issue is that the Fed only able to backstop this system when it runs into trouble. And the dynamic effects of that over time are very problematic. The distributional impact leads to financialization, huge financial profits. The financial sector is able to privatize its gains from risk-taking during good times and then turn to the Fed and the government when things go wrong during bad times. And we also have this dynamic now where, since the Federal Reserve has put its balance sheet to use in a big way, expanding it trillions of dollars to support this shadow banking system, there's now increasingly demands from across the political spectrum for the Fed to adjust its balance sheet usage to further other social and political goals. So the Fed has really put itself on the map as a major political actor outside of sort of fine-tuning the money system, now that it's clear that it can lend outside the banking system in a big way.
We're talking to Lev Menand, Columbia law professor, author of the new book. We're talking about The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of economic policies would you want to see from a president, from a Congress, from the Federal Reserve? Are you worried about growing influence, maybe overreach of the Federal Reserve? Do you think that we need reforms to the banking industry to consider some of these shadow banks our guest is talking about? Part of the banking industry. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Columbia Law Professor Lev Menand. His new book is called The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about the Federal Reserve and how we manage our economy, whether there's too much pressure on them to do it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Appleton. Mark, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. So 20 years ago, at the turn of the millennium, the national debt was $5.5 trillion. It's now $30 trillion. The Fed balance sheet was $500 million. It's now $8 trillion. And all of that extra stimulus has worked its way into the financial system to do one thing, and that is to make the economy bigger. My question to your guest is, how will we know when the economy has gotten big enough?
Mark, thanks for the call. Lev?
So the goal of the Federal Reserve is historically to ensure that there's enough money in the economy to allow everybody who wants to work to get a job and all the productive resources of the country to be productively employed. And so economists at the Fed spend their days trying to figure out what the economy's full potential is, how many resources are available, and what would it look like if they were fully employed, all being used. And if they were all being used, how much money would there need to be in the economy? How much money in credit? And are we above or below potential GDP? And they create projections, and then they try to set policy as a function of those projections. The actual debt of the government and the actual size of the balance sheet are only indirectly related to the Fed's efforts to ensure that the financial system is creating enough money and credit to keep the economy's resources productively employed. And one thing that we do know is that over the last 15 years, we've not been growing at our full potential, and that we've repeatedly been missing to the downside. And that's part of why many Americans over the last 15 years have perceived the economy as not being as good as the economy that their parents grew up in, and have generally negative perceptions of the economy, because we've actually been missing to the downside year after year.
Mark, thanks for the call. That balance sheet, though, Lev, the Fed and the chart in your book is really quite impressive, not necessarily a good way, how much more the Fed is holding in various kinds of debt that it's picked up and other things.
Yeah, so historically, up to 2008, the Fed's balance sheet was a sort of passive variable in Fed's policy. It was however big or small it needed to be based on how much physical cash people, ordinary households and businesses in the economy needed to conduct their day-to-day transactions. And so if Americans needed more cash, the Fed would create more physical cash and give that cash to banks, and that's how the cash would enter the system. And so it wasn't used as what we would call a policy variable. Fed officials didn't get together and say, let's grow the balance sheet. It just grew or shrunk based on how much cash people withdrew from banks. Starting in 2008, when the shadow banking system ran aground, the Fed started to expand its balance sheet actively as an active variable in a way that wasn't actually related to how much cash people needed. And so you see the Fed's balance sheet grow from $900 billion, which was mostly about how much cash was in the economy, physical cash, to trillions of dollars. And those dollars were digital dollars. They weren't physical cash circulating in the economy. They were ledger entries on the Fed's books that it used to buy financial assets, securities. And this was a transformation in how the Fed used its balance sheet. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that a lot of this transformation, including a program called quantitative easing, was a byproduct, directly or indirectly, of the Fed's efforts to stabilize the shadow banking system, something that the whole legal framework for money and banking in the U.S. Doesn't sort of anticipate would exist, but does exist, and the Fed needed to figure out some way to keep it from completely imploding.
Thanks for that call, Mark. We'll go to Jim now in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Thank you. I'd like to know the role of savings and loans back in the 70s and 80s, especially how were they viewed in this whole scenario about the amount of deposits that they maintained. They were, you know, I remember the 3-6-3 rule, and you know, they were the backbone of neighborhood economies. What happened to them with the creation of these investment banks in the 80s?
Jim, thanks for the call. I remember Lev, the SNL, the savings loan scandals and collapses. Briefly, where do they fit into this picture?
Of course, terrific question. Mm-hmm. So when I've been using the word banks throughout this call, I've been referring to, there's actually a collection of different chartered banks and different types in this country. And so there are chartered commercial banks like JP Morgan, but there are also savings and loans, thrifts, that are federally chartered. And there are thrifts that are state chartered. And there are credit unions. And all of those entities maintain deposits. And so all those deposits are part of the money supply. They're part of the instruments people use to store value and to conduct exchanges. And so the thrifts are part of the banking system. And up until the 90s, we had a very diffuse, decentralized banking system. So we had thousands of commercial banks, we had thousands of thrifts, and we had thousands of credit unions. And there wasn't like one or two huge ones that dominated. The savings and loans crisis of the 1980s was a function of a number of things, but one of them was regulatory differences between the thrift system and the banking system, and regulatory competition, loosening of standards, So managing within the banking system has historically been a problem. The rise of shadow banking has interjected a whole new dimension because here's a new competitor for all of the different bank types that we have under the legal regime that's not even within the sort of traditional legal framework for banking. And so the 90s and the aughts are the story of the emergence of all these other types of entities, as well as a sort of related change in the law of how the regulated banking system worked that allowed for conglomeration. And so you have the emergence of major financial conglomerates and very, very large banks, and the concentration of the banking system in the 2000s and the 90s. And nowadays, thrifts are a much smaller part of the monetary system than they were in the 80s, just as the banking system itself is a smaller part of the monetary system. Mm-hmm. In about 2007, 2008, half the sort of money supply was shadow bank money. So deposits were much, much smaller part of the money supply than they used to be.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Lev Menand about his new book, The Fed Unbound. Lev, I want to take our last few minutes and look at solutions. One solution you really point to is Congress taking a more active role in using other kinds of tools. I want to get one, for instance. You talk about options for Congress in dealing with the kind of inflation we're seeing nowadays. What kind of things could you see Congress and the president doing to tackle some of the causes of inflation?
So obviously, monetary tightening is part of addressing certain types of price rises. But we shouldn't look to the Fed exclusively to address inflation, because inflation has a lot of causes, oftentimes non-monetary causes, and the Fed's tools are very blunt. We would be much better off as a society if we could address inflation in a more narrow way, rather than slowing down the entire economy so that supply and demand equilibrate, address areas where supply and demand is specifically out of whack. So there's a couple ways to do this. One is through fiscal tightening. So Congress can raise taxes in areas that are overheating. It can also reduce its own spending in areas of the economy that are overheating. I also think the United States should have industrial policy again. And so there are certain sectors of the economy where supply and demand are out of whack. Healthcare has experienced enormous inflation. Energy has experienced inflation. Housing experiences inflation. So rents are up and housing prices are way up. And the federal government should have a national plan for those sectors of the economy to increase supply, to bring prices back down again. And that's something that Congress used to be more engaged with. And it would be to everybody's benefit, I think, for Congress to turn to that again, as well as to the executive branch, so that we try to increase the capacity of the economy in order to get out of inflation, rather than reducing economic growth to slow inflation, which makes everybody worse off than the alternative.
And in just our last minute, Lev, the shadow banking industry, these bank-like things that aren't regulated like banks, what would you like to see happen?
We have to rationalize our bank regulatory system. In insurance, if you issue a product that looks like insurance, that talks like insurance, that walks like insurance, insurance regulation applies. In securities regulation, same thing. You can't issue stock securities and call them something else and not follow the securities laws. In banking, for far too long, you've been able to copy the bank business model, say you're not doing banking, and not have to follow the banking laws. That has to stop. Fundamentally, we have to change the law so that any entity that does something that looks like banking follows the same rules as all the other entities doing something that looks like banking.
Lev, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lev Menand is an associate professor of law at Columbia Law School, a former U.S. Treasury official, and author of the new book, The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. He's with us today looking at ways to reform our economic system to be less reliant, he says, on the Federal Reserve. Coming up after news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, 40% of baby formula is out of stock in the U.S. A reporter tells us why, then a pediatric nutritionist tells us what parents can do if they're having a hard time finding these formulas in their area. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.